everyone. Welcome to Hooked on Science. I'm your host, Julia Cubans, and this is a podcast where we learn about cool research that you should know about. Now, I don't have too many things to go over before we start the episode, but I do want to remind you that if you have a topic that you are bursting at the seams to hear more about, or someone that you would really like to hear from on the show, you can go and recommend either of those things on the link tree, which is in the episode show notes. If you click suggest guests or topics, that button, that will take you to a form and you can let me know about what you're thinking. And I always consider guests or topics that people suggest. So if you're feeling shy, don't. I would love to hear from you. If you are new here, I would ask you to consider subscribing to the podcast. New episodes come out every 2 weeks on Thursdays, and we learn about a broad variety of science topics that I think you will probably find something that you are interested in. Today's guest is Dr. Vikram Baliga, who is a greenhouse manager and lecturer at Texas Tech University. You may know him from the Planthropology podcast. You may know him from social media. You may know him from school. I don't know. Or maybe you don't know him at all, but Vikram was one of the first people I connected with on plant science podcast social media, and so I am so excited to finally have him on the show. And after this episode, I am certain that you will want to check out his podcast, which again is called Planthropology, and I'll link to that in the show notes so that you can check that out when you're done with this. But for now, we are going to be learning about water conservation in urban landscapes, so let's get wet and wild. Hi, Vikram. Welcome to Hooked on Science. How are you today?
I'm good. I think I'm doing good. It's been a week, but I'm doing good.
You start classes next week. I guess at this point it will be after classes start when this airs, but it's kind of a crazy busy time in your world these days.
It is, you know, as we record this, it's what, Thursday, and classes start Monday, and I still haven't sent out my syllabus, so I'm a terrible professor, I know, but and then also my son started kindergarten this week.
Oh my gosh.
And so we're trying to adjust to that, and that's been an adventure.
Yeah, I'm sure both a big milestone and a big hurdle to,
oh my goodness,
work into the personal lexicon.
Well, it is, and I don't, like, at least where I am, the tardy bell rings for elementary students at 7:45.
That is early for sure.
Yeah, so we're like trying to get him okay, we have to wake him up at 6:30 so he eats breakfast and has pants when we leave. Like, it's a challenge.
Oh gosh. Okay, well, outside of being new kindergarten parent and navigating that, and then also lecturing, you are, well, a lecturer, a plant scientist, a greenhouse manager at Texas Tech. Can you tell me a little bit how you went from being your own self, a kindergartner, to this position here now?
Honestly, like, I just grew up loving plants, and then you know, went through school, and my granddad was a doctor, like a medical doctor. And so, like, I always wanted to do that growing up. I was like, I'm going to go into medicine. I'm going to do all this. And then through high school, I got really interested in, like, physics and engineering and some of those things. And so I was like, I know what I'll do. I'll major in biomedical engineering. So I was out of my dang mind, you know. Yeah. And I was like, I'll go to med school. I'll do, you know, medical prosthetics. I don't know. But then I realized I'm not good at calculus. And I realized after interning with at a doctor's office that I really don't like blood that much. And all those things were going to be problems.
That's fair.
And so I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. And so I got in horticulture because it's something I've always liked. And someone an advisor suggested to me that I just find something I like. And they were like, yeah, I mean, the money will come or it won't. But if you do something you like, you know, you can, it's a good place to start.
Yeah, for sure.
My undergrad, I actually have a Bachelor of Arts in horticulture, which is kind of different. I studied landscape design, and then I switched to a Master of Science. Also in horticulture, I studied olive trees and drought tolerance and water use efficiency in South Texas olives, that are grown for oil production. Then after that, I took a couple of years off. I was done with my master's, and I was like, I am never setting foot in a classroom again, which is, I know, silly to say that because that's not, you know, how it works all the time.
It's funny how often the joke is on us when we're saying, I'm never doing that again. And then whatever it is, it creeps back in and it's like, oh, this is my everyday.
I'm always in the classroom now. Yeah. So I ran a landscape company for a couple of years because when I got out with my master's, it was 2012. There wasn't a lot in the field available at the time. So I was like, I know how to landscape. I've got, you know, a degree in that. So I landscaped for a couple of years. Then I got a job with Extension and I was a county agent for about 4 years. And somewhere along the way in there, I got talked into coming back to do a PhD. And ultimately, I graduated in December, this past December of 2020, with my doctorate. And I've worked with Texas Tech since 2018. I came on as the greenhouse manager as I was finishing my PhD. And then after I finished, they have moved me into a sort of 50-50 greenhouse teaching role. And so it's an interesting position. It's kind of different, but I have a lot of fun doing all the different things I get to do.
Yeah, no, I think that sounds like it's probably a little refreshing to be like, oh, well, I'm tired of the greenhouse. Whoever says that? Nobody says that. Say, well, now I can go teach some undergrads some fun new things about plants and, you know, be able to switch it up and then be podcasting too. There are so many options.
Oh, yeah. Well, and so I teach introductory horticulture and is a non-majors, well, it primarily non-majors, you know, core science course. And so my section, my lecture section this semester is 153 students.
Oh my gosh.
Uh-huh.
That's a lot to wrangle.
It is a lot. And so, but I enjoy it. I really like lecturing. I really like teaching. But it is also nice to be able to come and play with plants and work with my, you know, staff of student workers, grad students, all that. And keeps things interesting.
And speaking of keeping things interesting in your time academically and professionally, you've gotten to work on a number of plants and crops in a lot of different capacities. You know, it seems like there's a common theme of water use and water conservation. And I think that's kind of a hot topic for a lot of places in the U.S. right now, considering how dry and droughty things have been this summer.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. Drought is an interesting thing because it's very regional. Drought can affect large areas, right? But the areas in which drought is present changes from season to season, from year to year. Drought tends to be sort of, in most places, sort of itinerant, you know, transient. It's here for a while, goes away. And then it's not everywhere. So for context, like I live on the high plains of Texas. I am in Lubbock, Texas. And if you're listening to this and have no idea where that is, that's totally reasonable. But we're in a semi-arid climate. We get, on average, 19 inches of rain a year. And so when I talk about drought and managing water resources, when I talk to people in my area, they're like, oh, yeah, you know, we're agricultural. We're heavily dependent on ground and surface water sources. We understand drought. But then, you know, I go across the state and I talk to people in Houston or the Gulf Coast area about drought, and they're like, man, we had two hurricanes this year. We want to get rid of all the water we've got, right? We've had too much. And so I think when we talk about drought, we have and water resources and all these things, we have to be careful to contextualize it.
Sure.
And say, in this area, in this region, maybe drought is persistent, maybe drought is common. But like in a lot of the places that are experiencing it right now, and in parts of the Pacific Northwest through the northern U.S., I know in Montana and some of the states where they grow a lot of hay, do a lot of cattle grazing, it's been a rough year.
Yeah, for sure. You're talking about drought being this kind of, you know, it comes and goes, you know, this kind of transient thing. Is drought defined differently in different areas? Because I know you're in a semi-arid area, as you just mentioned, and you don't get that much rain. Is the threshold for saying that, like, you're in drought more, or I guess lower maybe, because you're used to less water than like somewhere like I live in Minnesota that typically does get quite a bit of water, not this year, but in other years?
You know, that's a great question. And I used to know a little bit better some of the statistics surrounding that. Yeah. They're not, you know, in my brain right now. But it tends to be deviations from the norm. Okay. So it may be a sliding scale in some places, right? So for us, if we go, it's not uncommon for us to go 6 weeks, 8 weeks without any rainfall.
Oh my gosh.
You know, during the summer especially, like sometimes July, August is real dry.
Yeah.
It has not been this year. Actually, this year, we're very wet.
Huh.
You know, whereas your part of the country is dry, we already have 22, 23 inches of rainfall this year, which is incredibly wet for us for the 1st of August or mid-August. So it can be a sliding scale based on what, you know, the average is, the norm is. There's a lot wrapped up into it. If you actually Google like U.S. Drought Monitor, you can pull it up and it shows you drought statistics for the U.S. And there's some more information on there about deviations and like how they calculate that. But essentially, it's like there's different levels. There's no drought. There's like mild drought, moderate, severe, and exceptional. So there's like different gradations to that. Outside of just the definitions of drought, I think we have to look regionally at what are the human impacts and the ecological impacts of drought in that area.
Yeah, for sure. And okay, this is kind of a random offshoot.
Okay.
I like to ask those. So if you have this drought scale that goes from, you know, no drought to exceptional drought or whatever,
yeah,
is there a flip side of that to be like a little bit of rain,
some
rain, like, oh my gosh, this is way too much rain. Like if you're in a hurricane prone place, or is it just, you know, no drought, flood?
You know, that's interesting. I don't know the answer to that. I feel like maybe there should be, because that actually plays a lot. You know, talking about agriculture specifically, that plays a big part in it too. Like, when is the rain coming? Is it coming at a good time for the crop? Mm-hmm. Are we trying to harvest when there's 4 inches of water standing in the field? Those things are important too. I don't know if there's a scale on that, but I think there probably should be if there's not.
Yeah, no, I mean, as you were just saying, in agriculture, too much water can be just as bad as not enough water. So it can get pretty hairy out there.
For sure. And I'll give you a great example. I mentioned, maybe when we were talking earlier, that we have a lot of cotton production where I live. Mm-hmm. And rain up through mid-August is excellent. But that's usually when we kind of terminate irrigation and let the crop kind of finish out. But once those cotton bolls are open and the lint, the fibers, are exposed to the elements, rain is not great. Mm-hmm. Like, it can cause degradation in the fiber quality. It can cause discoloration, mold, all these different things. Also, the way the machinery works, you can't really harvest wet lint very well. Wet bowls very well. Even if the humidity is too high, they can't go out and harvest because it strings it out. It destroys the fibers.
Yeah, I've never worked with cotton, but I guess what I think of like fluffy fiber things, either, you know, the little dandelion seeds that are blowing in the air mm-hmm. sometimes, or, you know, I guess cottonwood trees with their little fluffy balls. I can imagine that trying to combine and harvest something fibrous when it's wet, because that stuff just, if it's like rainy, it just sticks to you.
Yeah.
It's not going anywhere. How difficult that would be.
And then when it gets baled, like, so they, you know, compact it into this big module thing and tarp it and leave it out in a field, if there's a lot of moisture in the middle of that, it can start the process of composting and decomposition.
Oh wow.
Which increases heat, and then you get a high flash point. Or like cotton has a low flash point. So you'll get these mm-hmm. modules that just literally spontaneously combust if it's too wet.
That's so scary.
It's so weird to think about, right? Like this module was too wet and now it's on fire. It's weird to think about. But yeah, you know, in our area, certainly poorly timed rain, you know, and mm-hmm. we take it when we can get it, I'll be honest. But
yeah.
But it can cause issues for sure.
So far, we've been talking about water. Too much water, too little water, but we're here today to talk about some of the research that you did during your PhD on urban landscape water conservation. Can you summarize that a bit for me?
My PhD research was more in terms of urban water conservation. So mm-hmm. during a drought, and even outside of drought, how do people that live in a city, that have a lawn, that have a landscape, that manage some kind of water that comes from a water utility, one, what can we do practically to save water, you know, through technology, through whatever else. So we did a field study related to drought tolerance in turf grass, because, you know, turf grass is like one of the largest planted crops in the United States. We have 43 million acres of turf.
Oh, man.
It's a lot, right? You know, I think
that's not nothing.
It's not nothing. And I think it's up there with corn, right? Like, it's it's a lot. So if we have all this turf planted, what technologies from, you know, infrared thermometers to wetting agents that increase plant fitness or water holding capacity in the soil, what things can we do to make that better? And then the other half of my project was more qualitative in some ways, and we tried to see what people were doing currently in their landscapes to, you know, in terms of water. And then what things a municipality or a water authority or an educational agency could do to influence their behavior, which is a lot. It was a lot to look through.
So thinking about that second part where you were asking people what they were already doing on their landscapes, was there like specific criteria for that? Did you target something specifically for this research to say, okay, all these people have a, you know, X shrub in their lawn or a X type of grass on their lawn?
That's a really good question. So we looked at it in two ways. We did do that to a certain extent. It's kind of tough, right? Because we wanted to build a survey that had more like scaled type of questions instead of free response, because those can be, we did have some free response, but those can be in the interpretation of data sometime a little bit more challenging to deal with. So for what we were doing, we were just trying to get an overview of one, what's out there, and two, how people are managing it in general. So we asked questions like, what is the general composition of your home landscape? Just lawn, lawn with a couple of trees, lawn with trees and flower beds, no lawn, rock landscape, those kinds of things, right? A xeriscape, whatever. And then we would ask questions about what, if you have lawn, what is the composition of your lawn? Is it, you know, we have primarily Bermuda grass where I live. Some tall fescue, a couple of other things, but it's primarily Bermuda grass and buffalo grass. And so we asked people what was in their lawn, and do you know, do you have multiple things? Just to get a little bit more context for what we were looking at, right? And then we would ask questions like, what kind of irrigation system do you have? Do you water by hand? Do you have a, you know, surface sprinkler system or an automated in-ground system? How often do you run it? How long do you run it for each time you do? What is your typical water bill? Do you understand what your water bill even means? Which a lot of people don't, turns out.
Yeah, that's an important thing to understand if you're using water, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not a homeowner. I don't know about homeowner landscaping things.
Yeah, well, but it is important, right? Like, do you know if you run your system for an hour? Whatever, how much water are you putting out? How much money are you spending on it? Mm-hmm. And all of those things are important when we talk about conservation, because what we were trying to look at is like, okay, if we figure out these things, we know what people are doing, how do we approach influencing behavior? Is it through pricing changes? Is it through better communication or regulation or other things? And, you know, if people don't understand how their water usage directly relates to their bill, maybe pricing's not an effective method, right? Mm-hmm. If they don't understand, another thing we looked at that's actually pretty important is we came up with a metric that we just kind of made up called perceived landscape importance. And we said, on a scale from whatever to whatever, how important is your landscape to you? Okay. How important is the appearance of your landscape, the health of your landscape, those kinds of things? And then we use that as a factor to put against some of the other behaviors to see like, okay, if people have a high perceived value of their plants, will they use more water? Are they less willing to adjust behavior? Are they willing to pay more for it? And that was actually a very useful metric as we looked at their behavior a little bit.
Yeah, no, that sounds really interesting. And being able to come up with, I don't know, I'm kind of envisioning like it is important or it's not important, and then, you know, a couple things in between. Having that as something to measure against all of these kind of independent-ish factors sounds like it would be really useful. But so just to contextualize this a little bit more, you already said you're in a semi-arid environment, 19 inches of water on average. Do most people water their lawns?
It is pretty common. Because you know, in order to really keep a landscape alive in our area, whether it's just lawn or lawn plus, you know, with trees and other things, we pretty much have to irrigate. We even on a good year, pretty much have to irrigate at some point because we have incredibly high summer temperatures, low relative humidity. So things dry out fast. Our, you know, evaporation rate's real high. And so, in-ground systems or some kind of irrigation is very common.
So this is, pretty ubiquitous in your area. People are watering their lawns. So I guess what my thinking behind that was if it's not that common, how do you then target people that are actually watering lawns? But it sounds like you would just be able to survey pretty much everyone.
So,
in theory.
In theory, yeah. And so that's actually a really good question. And this is, I think, maybe meaningful when we talk about how we do survey style research, is we used an online service to distribute our surveys. So there's different ways you can do it, right? You can send out mailers with like a water bill. You can put it on the internet and have them do it. So we actually designed our survey. We designed it with several like weed out questions early on in the survey. So if they answered, no, I don't manage the water in my landscape, they would get kicked out. Oh, thanks for your time. Bye. You know?
Sure, sure. The power of technology is amazing in that where it can say, well, if you said no, I don't want to hear about what you had to say for lack of a better term.
Yeah, and so we ended up with about 300 respondents in our survey. So it was, again, some of this is largely in our area is preliminary data. And so for that, we had a decent survey and a decent sample size based on our population and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah. So were you looking at, you know, targeting people within, you know, the city limits of where you are or in the county? Like what, how did that distribution look? And, you know, rain can fall slightly different in slightly different places, but what was your distribution technique, I guess?
So what we did is we looked throughout our, it was more regional than just city-based. So we looked at kind of the panhandle of Texas. If you're a Texan, you'll know these words. And if you're not, it doesn't even matter. But like from like Midland kind of north, you know, so the whole panhandle area. And so what we did is we looked at the average rainfall for the whole area, and we kind of picked our distribution on areas that have very similar rainfall patterns, right? So, you know, the whole survey area had between about 18 and 20 inches of average rainfall. So it averaged out to about the amount of rainfall that we have here. And so we tried to target people that were on some kind of municipal water supply. Though we did get responses from people that had private wells. That was a question in there, like, where do you get your water from? It was a fairly low percentage. But that was interesting, too, to see some of the differences between how people that were on their own well and maybe not in the heart of a more, not urban, but more population-dense area versus someone that lives in the city. Like, that was interesting context as well.
Okay. Very interesting. So after the survey, after you did this, was there any kind of outreach component that was a natural follow-up to the data that you found and collected in this to either, you know, educate people about, I know you said like thinking about water bills or educating people about how to either think more critically about their water consumption or how they used water in general?
That's something we're working on. I'm really bad at publishing, I'll be honest. And so like I've got like a stack of papers I need to finish writing. But we are hoping once some of our, you know, data is out there a little bit more to start working on some extension style publications and doing more outreach of, hey, you know, if you reduce your consumption by this much, you may save this much, but your plants will still be fine. Right. And those kinds of things. So that not a lot of that has happened yet. But that is something we're planning on of working with our local extension agency, just working through the university as well, to do some public outreach and public communication about this. Because I think that is important that, you know, we want to communicate to the municipality itself, to the water system. Because, you know, we found some interesting things that it's probably no surprise that pricing does have a pretty big impact on people's water usage. Or theoretically does. They indicated that it would. But that there's sort of a break-even point, right? Like increasing a water bill by 10% may not be enough. Increasing a water bill by 50% might be enough. But we also found that there is some value in good communication, in good messaging, in things like appeals to the common good, and like ideas of land stewardship and water stewardship. And in an agricultural area like we have, where people are fairly connected with agriculture and the land and the need to have water, there's some positive impact there and some potential. So that stuff we're working on, and we're hoping in the next couple of years to maybe do some follow-up research on this. To this point, we were looking more on the respondent side, but we're hoping to follow up and actually take some of that and try to work with the cities or some of the cities represented in our study to actually quantify those responses. Like, okay, people said that they're using X, Y, and Z, and they're doing X, Y, and Z based on water bills, based on consumption, based on the number of citations you write. Like, does that hold up? And then go from there and actually put out some more information based on that.
Yeah, no, that sounds really interesting in that it might, you know, as opposed to some of the science that people do, isn't necessarily like relatable on a daily basis to a lot of the broader public, but this seems like something that might be easier to get to people and have them be thinking about more critically because it's something they do every day. It's something that's very much in their realm of daily life as opposed to, you know, crop yields for X crop and how that relates to the water irrigation / rainfall in the area.
Sure, and if you look at it right now, there's a couple of fairly distinct camps in the way that people approach science communication, and there's a lot of shock and awe out there, right? And maybe with good reason. You know, there's a lot of very disturbing data coming out about like water and climate and virus, you know, all kinds of stuff. But is that the most effective way to influence behavior? That's kind of what we want to see. And are there better ways we could maybe message with relatable and practical solutions that, you know, maybe are presented in a way that are harder to politicize and all of these things?
You're saying that clickbait titles are not the best way to advertise agricultural.
It's shocking, right?
Worldwide phenomena.
Yeah, it's shocking, right? Like, you won't believe what they found in the study, right? I think that this is maybe me being optimistic, but I think most people, when you really get down to it, are fairly reasonable. I really think that. But we have to filter our reason through our worldview, right? And so when everything is so polar, you know, and separated, and you're in this camp or you're in this camp or you're that and that or that, reason sometimes struggles because our worldviews are so divergent sometimes.
Yes.
But I think if we can find a way to say, okay, everyone needs water to cook spaghetti, right? Everyone wants to keep your tree alive. If do you like peaches? Do you like fruits? We need water for that. I think, and then if we can couch that in a way that, look, we're not asking you to totally sacrifice your comfort and everything you like to do in life, maybe just make two or three small changes that really aren't going to affect that much in your day to day, and look at the giant impact we can have if we can all do it together.
Yeah, right? For sure.
That's how we should be presenting a lot of things where we're trying to really have positive impact on behavior.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think from, you know, what I've read in my research that I'm doing on science communication, that is one of the techniques that you can use to get information across in a not nonpartisan necessarily, but it's called framing theory, in which you are presenting all the facts to different groups of people, you know, wherever they stand on the issue, but you pivot it just a little bit to say, okay, maybe you're cooking a lot of spaghetti. How much water do you use your, I don't know, Italian restaurant? Like, put it into that context. I know you're talking about landscapes, but just putting it into the context that it makes sense to people and is relatable and will actually translate to what they're thinking about, and hopefully also translate to some positive changes.
Yeah. And it's a challenge. And I think that it's something we all have to work on. And, you know, as academics, sometimes we are not trained well in that, right? That's maybe not the main goal, but I think that it's something that's important. I think it's something that we have to be, and not everybody. I'm not saying that everyone out there that does research or that does science or that works at a university has to be doing SciComm, right? But there's people like you with a great podcast that can do that a little bit. And I think that we need to be supporting that in the sciences, supporting that in academia, and figuring out how to incentivize good science communication and good outreach and good messaging for the people that want and have the skills to do it.
You have a podcast as well, and I think education for, you know, the general public is a broad goal for both of our podcasts, and mm-hmm. that it, as you were just saying, is not incentivized in academia. The people that are generating research and looking at the science and learning more about it. We're trying to figure out how to get it into the world. But I think that's a great pivot point to talk a little bit about your podcast. So you're not only greenhouse manager, lecturer, you're also a podcast host of Planthropology, which focuses on some of the cool science that people are doing, some fun conversations around plants and kind of the greater plant world. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you came to start the podcast?
Sure, yeah. I was having a nerdy conversation about plants with a friend of mine, which is kind of what we do when we get together. And, you know, I just kind of jokingly said, hey, this would be a great podcast. And we both laughed because we were like, no, it won't. You know, whatever. And then I kept thinking about it. And we, around the same time I started it in 2019, we had just recently appointed a new department chair mm-hmm. here in our department. And as he was going through his interview process and all of that, he was talking about outreach and talking about public communication and SciComm and all of those things that we've just been discussing, you know? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, we need to maybe investigate other ways to do it, whether that is like through YouTube or working with traditional media or podcasts or whatever. And I was like, oh, hey, I thought about doing that a few months ago. And so I kind of started it and didn't tell anybody. So nice. They didn't fire me, which was great. And over time, like, he has been, or my department and our college has been so supportive of it that they've kind of worked it into my job description. So this SciComm is actually part of my job, which I love doing.
That's awesome.
And, you know, it's really just trying to tell stories. There's two goals. I want to tell stories to people in general about folks that love plants, that love nature, that love the environment, and try to build up some more passion about those things in people that listen to the show. And I try to do that by telling more of the human side of the story of, here's a real human being that studies whatever, you know, here's why they like it, here's how they got into it. And then we talk about the science, and that's great, but I think when we put that in the context of a real human experience, that it's more relatable. Mm-hmm. On the other side of that, I think one of the holes we leave sometimes in our educational system, advanced college educational system, is we're real good at saying, okay, here is 4 to 5 or 6, whatever, however many years of undergraduate education. And, you know, you've spent a large chunk of your young life and $80,000 learning about soil. Now what?
Yep.
You know, what do we do next? In 10 years, what do you do with that? In 20 years to next year, what do you do with that? And so I'm looking for people to interview kind of in all walks of life, whether still in school or in industry or in academia or just volunteering somewhere and everything in between. So the people, our students, people that are interested in this field can maybe get a picture of, oh, you know what, there is potential for me to go into floral design or mm-hmm. landscaping or food production or water conservation or whatever else. So I think I'm just trying to tell the story of the green industry as a whole. And our connection as humans back to it.
Yeah, I think that is such a valid and necessary thing to have, especially in the plant sciences. Going into, even though I knew, for me, I wanted to work with plants, the only avenues I really saw before, you know, going out of my way to learn more about it, think more about it, was, you know, you could be a professor, you could be a farmer, you could be an extension agent. And that was kind of the run of things. And so I think it's so helpful to maybe, you know, young scientists who are interested in this side of science to hear more about what people are doing and such the the crazy broad, I think, often possibilities that can come with this field and the surrounding fields too.
Yeah, and it's been a lot of fun. And it's maybe a thinly veiled excuse to find cool people to talk to. I don't know. I've gotten to interview a lot of old friends and make a lot of new friends, and that's been a lot of fun. And I just have fun doing it. You know, I don't know where it goes. I'm going to keep doing it as long as people will let me do it, and as long as people want to listen to it. I'm, you know, kind of committed to there are plenty of plant people to talk to.
That is for sure.
You know, you'll be on an up. I don't know when this is releasing, but you will have either already been or will be about to be on an episode, and it's been fun connecting and you know, learning more about what you do, and it's just, it's cool.
Yeah, and I know when I first started my podcast and I kind of entered the world of podcast social media and just trying to see what people were doing, and it was so nice to see that there are people who have podcasts that are, you know, similar to both of ours and are just really looking to talk about people and talk about science and how those things fit together, and as you said, humanizing the science a bit, but then also, you know, learning, which is awesome. But I remember back when I first started, we'd like followed each other on social media, our podcast accounts, and you had commented on one of my early, you know, episode release posts being like, oh, this is like a really cool idea. I think it, you know, is a good direction to go in. And that was so encouraging to me as a new podcaster, but then also some like validation to see like other podcasters who are doing similar things, you know, reaching out, and there's like a community surrounding this, but also that there's avenues to communicate science outside of academia.
For sure.
And you know, people are doing it and connecting, and it's been so cool.
Yeah, and I will say that this podcast community is so awesome. You know, I interact with a lot of like science and nature and other related podcasts a lot on Twitter and social media, and I've made some really great friends just through doing it. And so I'd say, you know, if you're out there and you're thinking about starting a podcast, reach out to the community. I think it's really unique in some ways that I think people are generally willing to help and give you their advice and give you their experience and all those things. And it's, you know, the field is still pretty open. And so like, it's not super competitive. We're just like, I think we all want each other to succeed. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I think, especially on Twitter, I don't know, I wasn't on Twitter until somewhat recently. And I was like, oh, it's, everyone talks about how it's such this like pit of negativity, but I found it to be unrelentingly positive in a good way, which has been, I mean, so cool to see on social media when it can get so nasty out there.
For sure.
But people are so supportive. So as we begin to wrap up, are there any, you know, takeaway points you want to hit on about either your water conservation research, about podcasting, just in general?
You know, I think as far as water conservation goes, I think that, you know, if you are in a place where it's a concern, you know, which is a lot of the U.S. and a lot of the, you know, North America this year, but consistently through parts of Texas and California and the southwestern U.S., like, don't be scared of making small adjustments, and don't let people tell you that your small adjustment isn't meaningful. I think we all have to do whatever we can to help. And if you can cut back on watering your lawn, if you can change the way you water your lawn through technology or just better practice, do that. There's lots of information out there about how to do it. And most of it's actually pretty approachable and pretty good information. Do what you can. I think that's a good message for all of us, whether we're talking about climate change or pandemic mitigation or water conservation or anything else. Like, we all have a part to play in resolving these issues. And we have let ourselves, I think, be convinced that all of the solutions to these problems are above our head. And they're not. It's not above your pay grade. You have the ability, and you have the, I think in some ways, the responsibility to take ownership of the issues that we all face. And that's part of living in a society and living in a community.
Yeah, I think that's great advice to end things on. How can people get a hold of you, listen to you, learn from you if they are interested in doing that?
I am unfortunately all over social media. you can look up some of the stuff that we're doing here on campus at Texas Tech Greenhouse on Facebook and Instagram. I am at Plant, or I'm, if you look up Planthropology on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, the handles are a little bit different because some of them weren't available. But look for the tree. Search for Plantapology. Look for the tree. That's me. And then I took whatever little was left of my self-respect and started a TikTok. So I am at the Plant Prof on TikTok if you want to do that too. But I'm pretty searchable all over the internet. If you want to just learn more about our department, if you're interested in what we do here at Texas Tech, you can just like Google Texas Tech Plant and Soil Science, and you can see kind of all of our programs and all of our stuff. We have a lot of online education. You can do a full, I think, bachelor's and master's degree online through Texas Tech in plant and soil science.
Nice.
And so wherever you are, if you want to learn more about plants, if you want to further your education, I think that you could do a lot worse than Texas Tech.
Perfect. Well, Vikram, thank you so much again. It has been a delight to chat with you today, and chat again soon.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
If you want to follow Hooked on Science on social media, you can do that on Facebook and Instagram by searching at Hooked on Science Pod, and on Twitter by searching at Hooked on Science. Thanks for listening.